The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, May 2018, Volume 20, Number 5. And this is the fourth and final installment of the May issue. On this month's cover, Oprah wears white wide-leg trousers, a white sweater, and white tennis shoes. Her straight, dark hair is parted in the middle and tucked behind her ears. She sits on a step in a completely white set. An ombre, magenta, and purple headline reads, "What can we agree on?" The big wide O for Oprah Magazine sits on a magenta and purple ombre background in the upper left-hand corner. And let's start out with part one of Holding Pattern. And this is advice from Martha Beck. And it is in the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine. Frazzled with work and family demands, Amina Akram is always putting others first. But O-Life coach Martha Beck wants her new client to start focusing on another important person, herself. As an airline ticket agent, Amina Akram spends her workdays accommodating people who aren't exactly at their best. "I have thick skin," says the 48-year-old who lives in Lilburn, Georgia. In her off hours, she cares for her 10-year-old daughter who's being evaluated for autism. She says, quote, "her teachers love her, but she has social challenges with her peers," end of quote, and her 22-year-old son who's in college. She also often ferries around her mother who lives with her and doesn't drive, and her sister who doesn't have a car. All the demands on Amina's time have left her depleted, depressed, and longing for a romantic partner's love and support, something she hasn't had since 2007. She says, quote, "I'm in the dating rut of my life. I've gone out with guys occasionally, but it's rare that I feel any spark. At this stage, I don't want to settle," end of quote. Now, Amina could use some help reaching her destination, and who better than life coach Martha Beck? Let's listen to their session in part one of our new series. Martha opens up with, "Amina, how are you?" Amina, "I'm wonderful. I'm so excited to talk to you." Martha, "Likewise. I hear you're incredibly busy tending to people." Amina, "It's just what I do. Now that you mention it, I need to make sure I can be done in time to get my daughter to her doctor's appointment." Martha, "Yes, I've also heard that you spend plenty of time in the car." Amina, "I'm like an Uber driver." Martha, can your son help?" Amina, "He's away at college. He does have his own car because I helped him buy it. I'm also paying for his insurance. I'm glad he's in school, but it would help if he could get a job to cover it." Martha, "And you're placating people at work all day. No one gets hassled as much as the people at airport ticket counters. That makes it hard to generate the energy for romance." Amina, "Yes, I think the lack of a partner is where most of my depression comes from. Last summer, I felt really bad. My mom had major back surgery, my son had knee surgery, and I just started the process of having my daughter screened for autism. I was overwhelmed." Martha, "The situation you're in isn't one humans have evolved for. We evolved to live in groups and share responsibility for the old, the young, and the sick together. You're trying to be the village for everybody. Women, especially new moms who care for others, have to take the focus off themselves, but they can become stuck in that mode even when their kids are older. They get more and more drained while no one really notices." Amina, "You speak up and they still don't notice." Martha, "Honestly, I'm glad you don't have a romantic partner yet. It's likely you'd be thanklessly meeting his needs too. I'd rather see you step into your power and then find your mate." Amina, "I've read that you attract the kind of person you are." Martha, "Actually, sometimes we attract our mirror image. People who serve without thanks often wind up with selfish people who want to be cared for. Your depression is trying to get you in touch with your healthy anger so you can set boundaries." Amina, "During that period when I really felt bad, I started medication and did short-term group therapy, which I loved. I'm better now, but still sometimes I just want to run away." Martha, "You should leave this pattern, not by checking out of your life, but by checking into it. That means finding the power to say no." Amina, "I feel like my family situation keeps me stuck." Martha. Believe me, I'm not asking you to get rid of your family. Just try changing the old pattern by figuring out what you need and asking for it. Let's play a game. Say you stop at a gas station to go to the bathroom and it's hideously filthy. Imagine I tell you I'm hiring you to clean it and I'll pay you $5. How do you feel as you start to do that job? Amina, disgusted. Resentful. Martha, angry. Amina, yes, anger. Martha, good. Okay, same scenario, but I'll pay you $50. How do you feel? Amina, a little better. Martha, are you thrilled? Amina, no. Martha, okay, now I'm telling you, I'll pay you $5,000. Amina, I have a smile on my face, even though it's the same repulsive place. Martha, what if it's $50,000? You'd have a song in your heart, right? And Amina laughs and says yes. Martha, I'm trying to show you how it feels to have different levels of reimbursement for your services. We all know that. When it comes to relationships, though, we disregard it. We're used to thankless work. But when we're offered what we're worth, that resonates inside us, physically and emotionally. Whatever we expect from the world is what we tend to get. We need to change your expectations so you know you're a person who should and will get paid what you deserve, in whatever form, money, health, love. And we change your belief system by finding the thoughts that keep you trapped. Let's challenge the thought, I'm stuck in this situation. I'm going to use a method called The Work, which was created by the writer and teacher Byron Katie. It consists of four questions. First, I'm going to take your thoughts and ask, is that true? You tell me whether it feels true. It usually does. Say, I'm stuck in this situation. Amina, I'm stuck in this situation. Martha, is that true? Amina, yes. Martha, now get quiet and still inside yourself, the way you might feel at night after everyone's gone to bed. Ask yourself this question as if you're tossing a penny into an endless well. Throw it into the depth of your soul and wait for an answer. The question is, can you absolutely know that you're stuck? Amina pauses. No. Martha, okay, you're on to something. Find the spot inside you where the no came up. The feeling that you may be heavily laden, but you're not absolutely stuck. Can you feel in your physical body where that hope is? Amina, in my stomach. Martha, that's because your gut has a deeper knowledge than your mind. It doesn't get stuck in thoughts like, this is what I owe my mother and my kids. Your gut's saying, when things got bad before I got help, I wasn't stuck. Third question, when you believe you're stuck, what does it do to you? Amina, it keeps me stuck. Martha, can you feel that thought weighing on you? You're not trapped at this moment, but the thought overrides the present and pins you down into depression. Now the fourth question. Who would you be if you didn't have that thought? If it just disappeared and you found yourself right here? Amina, I'd feel free. Martha, and to feel free is to be free in your heart, which is where every positive change begins. To be free in your heart is to attract other people who are free and to let you be free. That's how you're going to find the guy. Before our next session, I'd like you to take any thought that causes you suffering and go through the four questions. You can download a worksheet at thework.com. You don't need to think about changing your behavior. You're changing your mind on a very deep level, and then everything else will shift. It's like cognitive behavioral therapy on steroids. Amina, that's what I need. Martha, you're ready for it. You're amazing. Amina, I don't feel that way, but thanks. Martha, take that thought, I'm not amazing, and try The Work. And let's talk again in a couple of weeks. Let's look now at the O list. This month is the Thanks Mom edition. Here in our fourth installment of the May issue, we're past Mother's Day. But who says that you shouldn't remember Mom all year? And we start off the O list with quick drying flat espadrilles, the classic raffia detail and distinctive top stitching is around the sole of these shoes. They're shown in three colors, navy, white, and bright pink. Here's the description from the magazine. How dry I am. These little wonders marry classic espadrille form with high-tech neoprene and rubber function. So if you love pina coladas and getting caught in the rain, not to worry. They'll dry in about 15 minutes. Beachcomber Espadrille Water Shoes, originally $68 to $86 per pair. Now 20% off with code Oprah. Go to SeaStarBeachwear.com. Next up, we have Robin's Egg Blue Leather Charms from You Know Where. That would be Tiffany and Company, to loop on mom's favorite handbag. The first charm, attached to a matching leather strap, is shaped like a key and is embossed in black lettering that reads, "Please return to Tiffany and Company, New York." The second charm has the same lettering and is heart-shaped. The final charm is shaped like a padlock and reads, T and Co., New York, 1837. Bag charms are $150 each at Tiffany.com. Also on this page, there's a deep magenta on the outside, orange on the inside, tote with laser-cut medallion designs on it. The heading reads, "Double your pleasure. Turn this laser-cut vegan leather tote with a removable zippered pouch inside out, and you've got another great color combination with which to schlep." $99 at ecodesign.com. Next, we're on to a stack of coconut macarons. We have the heading, "We now pronounce you delicious." Design superstar Vera Wang and renowned pâtissière LaDure have married their talents in this limited edition set of coconut cream chantilly macarons. They're $24 for a box of six at LaDure.us. And they're in an elegant black tin with a silver scroll design on it. Her next item is entitled, "Have More Fun in Bed." A soft chemise in ivory silk with a wildflower design of coral, lavender, and olive green. Zoe Knighty in Loire, originally $128, now 20% off with code Oprah at molly-pepper.com. Lookout is the next item. Save precious purse space with these bright folding reading glasses. They're the classic round lens with the plastic frame and the real high hinge on the side of the lenses. They're shown here in bright red plastic or blue gray, and they're $45 from izipizi.com, izipizi.com. Now, who says that Mother's Day is only for mothers? Foot Nanny makes a fluffy sock and nourishing cream kit that your sister and auntie can enjoy too, so you can shower the people you love with shea butter, cocoa butter, and essential oils. The Mother's Day collection, originally $48, now 25% off with code Oprah at footnanny.com. And they show the gray tufted terry socks and the little pots of oils and butters. Pop It Up is the title that's shown here with two adorable pillows. And let's read this description. Upload a picture, choose your fabric, and immortalize your beloveds with a charming customized pillow that will always be allowed on the sofa. The first one here is a smaller rectangle in a deep, deep pink velvet, and it has this adorable kind of ivory and tan, well, cocker spaniel looking dog in a sitting position. And the second pillow is a little bit longer rectangle, and it has five puppy dogs sitting, looking kind of off to one side, and they appear to be on maybe a linen or an off-white velvet cushion. And those dogs are in shades of brown. I'm not quite sure if it's a fabric applique on or perhaps an embroidery. Sarah Gibson Wiley for Hugger Memories Custom Pet Portrait. They're originally The pillows are originally $195 to $295, and they are now 20% off with code Oprah. Go to HUGERmemories.com to find out more. In the center of this page, we're looking down at the top of a gorgeous bunk cake that's been dusted with confectioner's sugar, and the heading is Slice of Heaven. Dense, moist, citrusy, this lemon drop bundt cake is a religious experience on a fork. $54 at pmdelights.com. Now we get the royal treatment for the classic Wedgwood blue and off-white earthenware. We have three flower pots here, and they're very straight. They sort of taper out, flare out a little bit at the top, and they have this sort of marble effect. When Josiah Wedgwood gave a pot to the Duchess of Devonshire in 1778, little did he know that Laura Cavendish, daughter-in-law of the current Duchess of Devonshire, would collaborate on a redesign of Wedgwood's iconic jasperware, using a new technique that creates an organic marbling effect. Talk about making history. Wedgwood Burlington pots from $75 each at Wedgwood.com. And finally, across the top of the page, we have some necklaces, several versions of the same style. They have an almost square stone that looks like it's been bezel cut just a little bit, but the stones are slightly irregular. They are hanging as a pendant, and they from point to point, so they're almost like diamond shape. And this, they are surrounded by a rope designed bezel, and they're held in with prongs, and they show them in every color from a deep onyx to a deep sapphire, a pale pink stone, and a turquoise stone. And they have varying colors of chains from rose gold to silver to gold. Remember when you made your mom a necklace from rigatoni and string? Well, it turns out she might have been faking some of her enthusiasm. These sparkly Kendra Scott necklaces will more than make up for any past pasta jewelry. Casey Long pendant necklaces, $65 to $75 each at KendraScott.com. Let's move now to a pretty lengthy article we have this month that is one of our special features, and it's called The Man in the Picture. And there is a stylized, photoshopped, if you will, image from the balcony in Memphis where Martin Luther King Jr. was shot, with the men standing around him pointing up at the roof next door. Her family secrets were too troubling to face, so she willfully kept herself in the dark. Now, Lita McCulloch-Seletsky finally reckons with her father and the truth. She writes, "You've seen the photo. April 4th, 1968, the exterior of Memphis's Lorraine Motel. A mortally wounded Martin Luther King Jr. lies on a second-floor balcony as blood pools around him on the gray concrete. The toes of his polished dress shoes stick out past the edge of the railing, over the cars in the lot below. Standing above him, three people frantically point to a rooming house across the street. A fourth person's gaze is fixed on the same spot, but with his right hand he holds a white towel to King's shattered jaw. It's this man I found myself unable to look away from when I first saw the photo at the age of four, maybe five. He seems to be in shock, but alert, tensed, ready to leap to his feet. Please, God, let this not be happening, he might be thinking. Or maybe he's thinking nothing of the kind. The man's precise reasons for being on that balcony have long been touched by mystery, even to me, and I'm his daughter. I have a flickering reel of early memories of my father, Merrill Mack McCulloch. His bare ankles as I play on the floor while he watches football and drinks beer, a flash of straight white teeth, him cooing his nickname for me, D. Sparkling, sun-dappled late 70s scenes, but there are darker ones, too. Mom and Dad shouting behind a closed bedroom door about his drinking, his affairs. Her tearful calls to her mother on an avocado green rotary phone, "I want to come home," she says. "My own helplessness and fear as our family's foundation crumbled beneath our feet. They divorced in 1980 when I was 4 and my brother 2, Mom moving us from an anodyne Northern Virginia townhouse to her soulful home city of Memphis. Later, she told me that I cried for Dad after we left. Apparently, I once fixated on a man I spotted when we were out shopping, convinced he was my father by the sight of his legs and shoes. Daddy, I screamed over and over. My brother and I were too young to understand the significance of his presence at King's assassination when Mom showed us that photo in the Commercial Appeal, our local newspaper. We knew only what she told us. That's your dad. He was a policeman. Conversation over. Now he had a new job that took him to foreign countries for long stretches. Every few months, we'd get a fat envelope bearing strange stamps, stuffed with photos and a letter in his long, loopy script. How are you? I'm doing fine. Your mom told me you're in kindergarten now. I hope to see you soon. In some photos, he wore a green military uniform. In others, he stood next to a Jeep. He was large-framed and commanding. His brown skin glistened in the Central African heat. He'd visit sporadically, swooping into town, always a surprise. In between these visits and missives, my brother and I had no idea where he was. Mom told us he worked, quote, for the government. Her expression told us not to ask anything more. In Memphis, there was a host of welcoming faces, Grandma and Granddaddy, 2 elegant aunts, and 4 uncles who seemed almost as tall as the ceiling. We stayed in Grandma and Granddaddy's neat white bungalow. It had the air of a cabin in the country, long clotheslines swaying with billowing fabrics and tidy rows of vegetables bursting through the backyard's dark-turned earth. Mom got a job as a reporter at the Commercial Appeal, and Grandma and Granddaddy took care of us kids. "You heard from Mac?" Grandma would ask Mom from time to time. Mom would affirm tersely and look away, conversation over. Once or twice a year, Dad's brown Dodge van, Big Chalk, he called it, materialized next to the curb. Straight-backed and ebullient, he would stride up the walkway, an exotic visitor bearing curious gifts, a straw mask with cowrie shell eyes, and foot-tall Japanese geisha doll. As I opened the door, he'd let out a full-throated laugh, saying, "Look at you, girl. Wow, you're getting tall." He'd kiss my cheek, his stubble scratching my skin, then turn to my brother with a "my man" before whisking us into Big Chalk's shag-carpeted belly. We went on whirlwind jaunts across the city, tasting bony slabs of fried buffalo fish and riding the Zippin' Pippin', Liberty Land Amusement Park's wooden roller coaster. When I was 11, Dad moved back to the U.S. and settled in Northern Virginia, this time with a new bride and her aging poodle. My brother and I visited them for Thanksgiving in their spacious colonial-style home, where African carvings and tapestries filled the airy rooms. Over that weekend, Dad took my brother and me to a boxy, featureless, low-rise office building we'd never seen before. He flashed an ID badge and breezed through security. We crossed a vast, cubicle-filled room to get to Dad's office, where he closed the door, then asked if we knew what he did. We said, "You work for the government." He told us matter-of-factly, looking us squarely in the eye, "Actually, I work for the CIA. He didn't elaborate beyond directing us to keep that information to ourselves. True to our word, my brother and I didn't talk about it with anyone, even each other. But I knew the CIA was a spy agency that carried out missions doing who knows what across the world. Did the CIA watch us at home, I wondered? Did Dad have a gun? What did he actually do for them? I became a bookish, surly teenager with a special interest in racial justice, having witnessed, among other things, the election of Memphis's first black mayor and the bigotry that his achievement coaxed from its hiding places. I pored over Alex Haley's The Autobiography of Malcolm X, France Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, a couple of books about the Black Panther Party. One day, an older boy I'd sometimes talk to about social justice issues called himself a radical. I liked the sound of that. I'm a radical, I announced to Mom in the car that afternoon. She shot me a look. She said, quote, "Don't you ever say that. You aren't any radical," end of quote. My face burning, I vowed to keep quiet about my political views. One afternoon in 1993, during my junior year of high school, I was lazily flipping through the Commercial Appeal when I came across an article about King's assassination. As I scanned the story, my father's name leaped out at me. The article said he'd worked undercover to infiltrate a Black nationalist group called the Invaders. Undercover. Infiltrate. I scrambled to assemble the pieces in my head. Dad wasn't just any police officer at the Lorraine Motel when King was assassinated. He was a spy. The revelation felt like a body blow. I read the words over and over, struggling to take a breath. Instinctively, I sympathized with the Invaders. I'd read about the dirty tactics FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had employed to destroy the Black Panthers, spreading misinformation, harassing members and their families, possibly even murder. But I didn't ask my father to tell me his side of the story. Not then. Not in the 18 months before I left for college, not even when I interned at the CIA over two college summers and lived with him and my stepmother. I grew to like him during those summers, enjoying the lighthearted banter that deepened the dimple in his right cheek. He asked one evening in the kitchen, "Remember how you used to love French fries when you were little? You'd shout, 'More French fries!'" I didn't remember. I wished I did. But I hadn't forgotten what I'd read, and it still scared me, especially after learning he'd been mentioned in a 1997 ABC Primetime Live segment that discussed conspiracy theories regarding King's assassination, and after hearing about a wrongful death lawsuit brought by the Kings against several unnamed co-conspirators, presumably including Dad. Alone at my computer, I'd occasionally leap down an online rabbit hole of innuendo and speculation, some advancing the idea that my father might have played a role in plotting the assassination. I just couldn't deal with that thought, so I packed it away deep in my subconscious. I was good at that. By the summer of 2010, I was 34 years old, a married lawyer living in Houston. I'd just had a second child, and his birth had set something aflame. What would I tell the kids about their granddaddy Mac? I could no longer ignore the cold draft that blew through my polite exchanges with Dad, so I picked up the phone. I tried not to plan what I would say. Instead, after some chit-chat, I simply pushed the words out. I said, "I've been thinking about how we've never discussed Dr. King's assassination. I really want to hear about your experience." Several beats of silence. He finally said, "Okay." I stammered, "And not just the assassination. There's a lot I don't know about your life, your childhood, your time in the Army, the CIA stuff." "That's a lot," he said, chuckling. "Let me get my thoughts together and I'll send you some notes. Then we can talk." He sounded relieved, even happy, that I'd asked. About a week later, he emailed me a 17-page document. I inhaled sharply as I opened the letter, which began with a formal preamble in bold-faced. "We'll be as forthcoming as possible, but will not disclose classified information. We'll keep my solemn oath to my friends and country." He launched into an account of his early childhood on a farm in 1940s Mississippi, describing his father. Friends called him Nap, Vanilla Brown, cross-eyed, hit an eye with rock as a child. And mother, prideful, primped in potato field. He felt protected until his first taste of white supremacy as a toddler, saying, quote, "At Cotton Gin, white man gave me a cherry soda. He'd been drinking from the bottle. I told him no, but Daddy made me take it. Why? Didn't understand," end of quote. That half-drunk soda was a show of dehumanizing superiority, as if my father were an animal happy to take a stranger's leavings. 3 pages in, I was heaving with tears, imagining other gut-wrenching anecdotes that awaited me. I put the notes aside. For 5 years. I know, but remember, I'd grown up under a family directive of don't ask, don't tell. I'd suppressed my curiosity about Dad's story for so long that 5 years seemed like nothing. I talked to him now and then and knew he must have been wondering what I made of his story, but I never brought it up. Then late one cold spring evening, with my husband working overseas and my kids tucked into bed, I was lonely and bored. Old aches and pains were roiling my spirit. I felt Dad's stories calling to me. In the darkness and silence, I started reading again. The notes cleared up the timeline. In February 1968, a mere 2 months after he graduated from the police academy, Memphis's unprecedented sanitation strike began. The police department, concerned that the radical invaders might orchestrate acts of mayhem, asked my father to embed with the group. They were staying at the Lorraine while assisting with King's upcoming march, and Dad duly reported their activities to the Memphis PD's Intelligence Division, which passed them along to the FBI. Dad wrote, quote, "My role was to collect information and to detect any plans for life-threatening criminal activity," end of quote. 2 months later, King was dead. Dad was a mole until 1969, when a community activist blew his cover. The discovery forced him to leave town temporarily for his safety. Activists had long been aware of snitches in their midst and viewed them with the utmost contempt. When he returned, he resumed his regular job in the department's intelligence division. But how could he spy on the invaders? Wasn't it treason to undermine people fighting for black rights? I steeled myself and asked him as much. That was a conflict for me, Dad admitted, his voice growing wobbly, going on to say, but enforcing the law equally, that's where I was coming from. By letting the department know the invaders weren't a threat, we didn't have to go in shooting like Chicago did during the Black Panthers raid. Two activists died in that incident in a hail of police bullets. What he was saying almost made sense. When Dad and I started talking about the assassination, his tone turned sorrowful. He didn't cry that day, he said. Numbed by shock, he locked into his professional duties. But a week earlier, when National Guard troops flooded the streets following King's first chaotic Memphis march, he'd been overcome. He said, quote, "I felt like those tanks were there to occupy the African-American community. It didn't matter that I was a police officer. They would have turned the 50-caliber machine gun on me. In my experience, soldiers, police officers, and CIA officers perform out of a sense of duty rather than how they feel about an assignment. How did I feel? I felt oppressed." End of quote. Finally, I asked him what I'd spent decades wondering. Quote, "Do you think James Earl Ray acted alone, or do you think the government saw Dr. King as a threat to national security and targeted him?" End of quote. After all, an FBI memo had called King the most dangerous Negro in the nation. Dad sighed. He said, quote, "I always believed that the U.S. government wouldn't assassinate its own citizens. I still believe that," end of quote. I understood. I get wanting to trust, even when a cacophony of voices tells you maybe you shouldn't. But sometimes stronger forces prevail. Though we live 2,400 miles apart, my father and I have a relationship now. We talk and email nearly every day and visit once or twice a year. We've bonded over our love of travel and weird food. We dream about visiting Ghana together, where he knows a restaurant that serves grass cutter, a giant rodent. He scolds me when I fail to send enough photos of my kids. I roll my eyes when he tells me how to shovel snow off my deck. I feel close to him in a way I'd never thought possible. As much as I love it, I need it even more. So when doubt creeps in and I rehash the conspiracy theories, the secrets he might be protecting to keep the solemn oaths he swore as a cop and CIA agent, this thought shuts down all others. I've heard my father's side. He isn't just the man in the photograph anymore. I know him, and I choose to believe. Let's move now to the Let's Eat section of the magazine. And we've started having a new monthly feature called Fast or Fancy. So we have a fast way to present, to prepare a dish, and a fancy way. We're looking down at a white oven dish that is filled with French fries that have been sprinkled with herbs and with a side dish of gravy. Sisters and lifestyle bloggers Emma Chapman and Elsie Larson, authors of the new cookbook, A Beautiful Mess Weekday Weekend, offer two mouth-watering ways to get your French fry fix. So let's look at the fancy version. A combo of sweet and white potatoes instantly ups your fry flavor game. And when you pile a gooey cheese and lush gravy a la Quebec's pièce de résistance poutine, you've got some special spuds. Preheat oven to 450 degrees. Peel one large russet potato and one large sweet potato and cut into fries. Soak in a large bowl of water for 20 minutes. Meanwhile, soak a half an ounce of dried mushrooms. Per package instructions, rinse and drain. Drain potatoes and spread on a paper towel lined baking sheet. Pat until fully dry. Place in a large bowl and toss with 1 tablespoon of olive oil. Over dried baking sheet, spread 2 tablespoons of olive oil to coat. Add fries in a single layer and season with kosher salt and ground black pepper. Cover pan with foil and bake 5 minutes. Remove foil and bake until edges begin to brown about 12 minutes. Turn each fry and bake again until edges brown about 12 more minutes. During the last 12 minutes, chop mushrooms into small pieces and set aside. In a medium saucepan over medium heat, melt 4 tablespoons of unsalted butter. Add 2 tablespoons of all-purpose flour and whisk to make a roux. Turn heat to low, and whisking constantly, add mushrooms and a cup of vegetable stock. Season with a big pinch each of cayenne pepper and cumin, and salt and pepper to taste. Simmer until thickened into a gravy. Divide fries into 4 bowls and top evenly with gravy, 1 cup of cheese curds or shredded white cheddar, and 2 tablespoons of chopped herbs, such as parsley, chives, or cilantro. Now, here's the fast way. If homemade fries are ambitious enough without gravy, just sprinkle on herbs and cheese-flaked Parmesan or crumbled feta, which adds flavor and texture, or load DIY toppings onto cooked frozen potatoes instead. We like Grown in Idaho's perfectly crunchy, hand-cut style fries. $3.50, and check grownindaho.com for stores. Emma Chapman has a food for thought quote here, which is, while any variety of sweet potato works well for fries, I prefer jewel over garnet, since they tend to have less water content, making for a crispier result. And we have one more item here in the Let's Eat section, and this is a marvelous-looking Italian sandwich, a close-up of this crusty bread stuffed with lettuce, cheese, salami, and cheese. And more cheese. Spread the Love is the heading. Gita De Laurentiis's zesty pesto from her new cookbook, Gita's Italy, takes the travel-friendly muffaletta to the next level. I'm always coming up with new versions of the charcuterie-packed muffaletta sandwich because it's a guaranteed hit, especially at a picnic or the beach. You can make it in advance. The longer it sits, the better it gets. And it's so full of meat, cheese, and greens that you don't need to serve anything else. When I was a kid, my mom used to pack it for lunch for school. It was the Italian version of a bologna sandwich, and I definitely got some curious looks from my classmates, but I was too satisfied with its tender goodness to care. My special ingredient? Basil almond pesto. I love the bright and herby sauce so much that I usually make a double batch and serve it over chicken or pork, or toss it in pasta or rice. Heaven. So here are the instructions for this marinated salumi sandwich. This makes 6 servings with a total time of 25 minutes. For the pesto, in a food processor, pulse 1/2 cup of raw almonds and 1 small garlic clove to chop coarsely. Add 1 1/2 cups of basil leaves, 1 teaspoon of grated lemon zest, and 1/4 cup Parmigiano Reggiano, and pulse to combine. Add 1/2 cup extra virgin olive oil and 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt and puree to a smooth paste. For the sandwiches, slice 1 large ciabatta loaf in 1/2 horizontally and pull out some of the inner bread, leaving a slightly hollowed crust. Spread pesto evenly on both halves. Layer 1/4 pound thinly sliced hot gappa or other spicy salami, 1/4 pound thinly sliced finocchiona or other mild salami, and 12 ounces lightly salted fresh mozzarella, sliced or torn. On to the bottom half. In a small bowl, toss 1 1/2 ounces, 2 cups, of baby arugula, 1 thinly sliced small fennel bulb, stalks and fronds removed, 1 1/2 teaspoons of lemon juice, and 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil. Add mixture on top of meat and cheese. Add 1/2 of bread, press sandwich together and wrap tightly in plastic wrap. Refrigerate overnight for at least 1 hour before slicing and serving. For De Laurentiis's Sicilian tuna salad sandwich and Positano pizza's recipe, visit oprah.com/Italian lunch. Let's go now to the reading room. And we have a review that is entitled Siren Song. And the book is actually entitled Circe. A novelist steeped in Greek mythology reimagines a misunderstood enchantress. In Madeline Miller's spellbinding second novel, Circe, the golden goddess of the title knows that history will remember her unkindly. Quoting from the novel, "Humbling women seems to me a chief pastime of poets, as if there can be no story unless we crawl and weep." End of quote. Readers familiar with the Odyssey may recall Circe only as the beguiling witch Odysseus beds while making his way back to his faithful wife Penelope, little more than a cautionary tale for men about feminine treachery. But in Miller's conception, Circe is the hero of her own epic. Though she's the daughter of the mighty sun god Helios, Circe has never been at home amid the Titans who rule cruelly over the mortal world. Even as a young girl, and despite being gifted with potions and spells, among them the ability to turn sailors into pigs, she's drawn to the charms of humans, warts and all. When the sea brings Odysseus to her shores, their romance is not a struggle for dominance, but a smoldering brew of eroticism and mutual understanding. As they part for good, Circe reflects, quote, "He showed me his scars, and in return he let me pretend I had none," end of quote. Through each of her suitors, be they mortal or divine, she evolves as a woman owning both her sexuality and her vulnerability, which are sometimes one and the same. Miller has created a daring feminist take on a classic narrative. Although the setting is a mystical world of gods, monsters, and nymphs, the protagonist at its heart is like any of us. A free woman, the author seems to be saying, must be willing to forsake the trappings of birthright and rank in order to claim her destiny, whether thousands of years ago or today. We have a quote here from the book Love Rules, How to Find a Real Relationship in a Digital World by Joanna Coles. And here's the quote. Dating apps are like cars. They need to be handled with care. They are unparalleled for broadening your horizons and taking you on journeys you might not have imagined, but you need to proceed with caution. And now we have one more book review. The book is entitled The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. The review is called Thirsty. The Empathy Exams author explores the allure of the bottle in a stunning hybrid of memoir and reportage. In The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath, Leslie Jamison's immersion into the consuming murk of addiction and the sparkling sea of its literature, the novels of Jean Rhys, with their abject heroines haunted by lost children and lovers, the short fiction of Raymond Carver, painful and precise like carefully bitten fingernails. The author asks, quote, if stories about getting better could ever be as compelling as stories about falling apart, end of quote. It's no mean feat, morphing the alcoholic's plodding modus operandi, more, again, forever, as Jamison puts it, into sentences that surprise and shimmer. But she achieves it here frequently, quoting, booze helped you see, and then it helped you survive the sight, end of quote. She writes of her youthful devotion to the sodden mythology, going on to say, quote, I idolized the iconic drunk writers because I understood their drinking as proof of extreme interior weather, end of quote. But even hurricanes get dull if you suffer through enough of them. About halfway into the book, Jamison admits, quote, I'd gotten sick of how melodramatic I was when I was drunk, end of quote. By which point the reader may share that sentiment. She goes on to say, quote, but now sobriety seemed to come with melodrama of its own. I was a martyr, end of quote. The self-involvement of the addict will not be dismantled by an effort as mundane and Herculean as not drinking. Reading the autobiography of Bill W., a founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Jamison contemplates narrative relapse, the tendency to reassume the aggrandizing storytelling of the drunk, even when sober. Jamison connects her insatiable appetite for booze with her yearning for male attention. In at least one case, the two needs converge in a boyfriend who imbibes and analyzes his own psyche as much as she does. And here's another quote. We were like two 24-hour archaeological digs happening side by side. Just when you thought we'd pause for lunch, we went deeper. It was no wonder we got drunk so much. We just wanted a break, end of quote. Sobriety, as configured by the 12-step model, requires relinquishing this grinding fascination with the self, this conviction that one's story is special and original, and striving instead for humility, the recognition of the shared experience of being human. The Recovering is Jamison's attempt to reconcile her relentless intellect and singular voice with the things that have healed her, fellowship and surrender. That wraps up all of the Reading Room reviews for this month. And now let's move to Love That. Adam's style sheet this month is a format that I personally have always enjoyed. He builds three different looks, beginning with a dress and finishing it off with accessories, handbags, and shoes. Adam says, say yes to the dress in the shade of the season, pink. No matter the occasion, there's an option to suit your style. And these pinks range from intense bubblegum to vibrant raspberry. The three occasions that Adam is helping us dress for are the garden party, the summer concert, and the farmer's market. Starting with the garden party, we have a raspberry pink and white fit and flare dress with a full skirt that falls just above the knee. It's sleeveless with a wide neck that isn't too low. The dress is $228 at nickandzoe.com. Adam chose a natural straw bag with white leather handles and trim from michaelkors.com. It's also $228. The shoes are a white sandal with a tall wooden wedge. They're $178 from JackRogersUSA.com. To finish off the outfit, we have a $395 bull of a watch with a rose gold metal bracelet and case and a mother of pearl face with inset diamonds that mark the hours. The next look is the summer concert. And this starts with a color-blocked raspberry and pink sleeveless scooped-necked maxi dress. Accordion pleats run from the neckline to the hem in this straight dress. You'll need the silver-framed, mirrored-lensed aviator sunglasses, $30 from PrevereVaux.com in the summer sun. There's more shine in the laser-cut-out silver slip-on sneakers from CVS.com. They're $98. Adam chose a white watch with a white smooth band from CitizenWatch.com. The $250 watch has a rose gold case. To finish this look, there's a black, gray, and white diamond geometric patterned clutch with a black shoulder strap from Vince Camuto. It's $138 at Dillard's.com. The third and final occasion Adam has styled here is a boho outfit for a trip to the farmer's market. The midi dress, shown here in a deep pink fabric with a small floral pattern, has long ruffled layers and short flutter sleeves, which are edged in gold trim, as is the deep V neckline. It's $425 from RoadResort.com. Four multicolored fabric-covered bangles with small gold charms are $25 each and can be found at RoseNasami.com. The flat slide-on sandals have mid-tan leather insoles and a wide gold leather asymmetrical strap at the arch of the foot and a small gold leather asymmetrical strap at the big toe. They're $260 from BeakShop.com. Finish this outfit off with a white, black, and bright pink striped fabric tote with a 4-inch gold ring handle and a pink and white pom-poms with pink and white pom-poms and tassels. The tote is from Gia Empowered Women, and it costs $158. The tassels are $36. We're getting really close to the end of this final installment, and this month is the Spring Beauty Awards. So we'll try to squeeze in 3 or 4 minutes of some of these awards. And first off is for the face. Complexion Perfection is the name of the game, and these products will have you looking radiant and fresh, whatever your skin type. So for a dry skin, the cleanser they're recommending is CeraVe Hydrating Micellar Water. Game-changing micellar water effectively removes makeup, dirt, and oil, but leaves skin plump, not parched. It's $10 at drugstores, and it's marked as a reader rave. The day cream is Clinique Moisture Surge 72-Hour Auto Replenishing Hydrator. This is for dry skin still. A refreshing gel cream that's lightweight but seriously moisturizing. And it's $39 at Clinique. The night cream, Clarins Extra Firming Nuit. Wake up looking more youthful thanks to kangaroo flower and moonstone extracts that help minimize droopiness and fine lines. It's $93 at Clarins.com. And then the treatment, Paula's Choice Rehydrating Moisture Mask. Your thirsty outer layer will thank you for this comforting cushion of uber hydrators such as borage, jojoba, and olive fruit oils. $39 at paulaschoice.com. And now let's move to what I know for sure, Oprah's closing comments. A mass shooting generation cries out for a change. I'm looking at the morning headlines and the faces of children looking back at me, children who will never know life on this earth beyond a last moment of terror at their school, yet another school. When I was a young journalist in Baltimore, assigned to cover a drunk driving accident, the death of a single person was enough to merit a lead position on the evening news. But over the years, the amount of death and destruction had to be ever greater to register with people. Eventually, it would take 7 children on a school bus coming back from Christmas caroling to make the top of the news. Until along came MAD, formed by a group of moms who'd had enough, and were mad enough to do something about it. We spend so much time focusing on the great divide in our country. The partisan politics of red states and blue states consumes a lot of our attention. But for CBS's 60 Minutes, I traveled to Grand Rapids, Michigan to interview 14 people from both sides of the divide. And when I asked, what really matters to you? There was one answer everyone agreed on: family. Protecting family, caring for family, loving family. Those 14 people were by no means an official survey, but I believe most of us would agree that reverence for family really is top of the list. All people belong to someone's family. So can we agree that all people deserve protection from senseless killings? Can we agree that all families deserve and have the right to safety in addition to the right to bear arms? I say this respectfully and with regard for the common good. Does anyone really believe that the Founding Fathers intended that AR-15s, bump stocks, and 100-round magazines be in the hands of people who have demonstrated, sometimes with blaring warning signs, that they can't cope in society? Can we agree to use our common sense to protect the common good, to require background checks, and prohibit those on terrorist watch lists from buying guns? It sounds inconceivable. I can picture future generations shaking their heads in disbelief that we the people would prohibit madmen who want to kill us from flying on planes, but not from buying weapons with which they can slaughter us en masse. What has become of our collective consciousness, our collective conscience, and our belief in doing the greatest good in the best interests of the most? I hope and pray that you agree. It's time to stand up and stand together for the sake of us all. And we have pictures here. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, high school student Emma Gonzalez, addressed a gun control rally in Fort Lauderdale February 17th. 4 days later, students went to Capitol Hill to protest gun violence, while Stoneman Douglas student Cameron Caskey spoke at a school walkout. And we finish up with answers to our question, what have you and a loved one agreed to disagree on? Yolanda Graham of Beaufort, South Carolina says, parenting techniques. I'm more laid back, but my fiance is strict. We've combined our approaches and worked out an issue that almost compromised our relationship. Barb Prescott of Northbridge, Massachusetts says, religion. My husband is an atheist and I'm a person of strong Christian faith. We follow our own paths without denigrating each other's beliefs. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.